Welcome back, everybody, to another C-Squared podcast episode. Here we are after a long time coming. We've both been on the road. We've both been to St. Louis. Fabiano, you played the American Cup as well as the American Cup Blitz, and many other things have happened in between the last episode and this one. So why don't we start with the American Cup? And first of all, what's up? How is it going? Anything new? And any new things in Fabiano world?
No, nothing super new. The American Cup ended a bit ago. Before that, we did our experimental episode, which some people liked, probably more disliked. Not sure, but
I would say anyway, the reviews were not great.
It was just for fun. I mean, obviously, it's kind of a silly format, but okay. It's just for fun. But yeah, after that, we played the American Cup, which I got second place. Hikaru Nakamura won in the final, which overall I felt disappointed about because I thought my level of play in classical was not very good. But the result, can't say it's bad or anything. I mean, second place, it's normally, you'd say, a pretty reasonable result. Okay, in a tough knockout format. But just because of the way I got there, didn't feel very satisfying. But yeah, besides that, then we play the American Cup Blitz, which is also sort of a fun event. You know, I didn't manage to win. I lost this like crucial penultimate game against Levon, which killed my hopes. If I had drawn that game, I think still some hopes. If I had won, then I would be in first place before the final round. And then I won in the last round against Wesley, which actually gained me a bit of rating overall in Blitz, so I can't say it was like a bad tournament. And I shared third place with Sam Savian. Hikaru won the Blitz. He had a close shave in the last round against Mihail Antipov.
Very close shave. A great event. Very close shave.
Actually, funny trivia for people. And Mihail was the coach for the United States Olympic team last year. The Olympic team comprised of myself, of Wesley, Levon, Lanier, and Ray. And in the American Cup Blitz, first Misha played Lanier, then he played Levon, then he played Wesley, then he played me, then he played Ray. And then for good measure, he also played Hikaru, who, although he wasn't on the last Olympic team, of course, has been on the Olympic team countless times. So that was a bit funny to see him go through the entire American Olympic team, and then some. So yeah, that was a fun event. I can't say I'm thrilled, of course, not to win it, but
well, I would say the rating. You fell short of defending the title, and in fact, you've been the only title holder at the American Cup Blitz. I think three editions, and you won all three of them. Before this one,
yeah,
this last one,
yeah, it's a bit sad. 3 years I've had this title.
It is, isn't it?
No, I mean it's not a major title, of course. The American Cup Blitz, it's sort of a fun final day. This year it was a bit smaller because usually, like in past years, there would be some players who would come from outside of Missouri. For example, last year there was Daniel Naroditsky. Trying to think of who else came from out of town, but there were definitely some like strong grandmasters who came from out of town. And this year it was just the American Cup players plus some other St. Louis and Missouri residents. So Columbia, as you know, people from your university, people from St. Louis University, from Webster and so on, they came, and then the American Cup players. So it was still super strong. I would even argue maybe stronger because it was such a small tournament. So basically from the like second round, I was playing Grandmasters.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a tough one. And I think it was what, like 60 players, something along those lines. We were expecting a bit more, but obviously once they made it only local, it was a bit more difficult. So we had players from three big universities, Mizzou, SLU, and Webster, and all of them competing against players from the American Cup and some players that are local and decided to play it. Very strong event. Obviously, there was some controversy surrounding it, as with pretty much any, to be honest, moving forward, it seems like every single St. Louis tournament will have some controversy as long as Hans is not invited. that's obviously really not going to be the case. Sorry. That's not going to be the case for the US Championship. Of course, we talked about it, and so that everybody
yeah, look,
kind
I think
of
that,
knows.
You know, having Hans in a tournament makes it super interesting.
It does. It does. I'm, but this is the situation right now.
I'm interested in playing against him in general, as he is now a legitimately top 15 in the world player. I think this is pretty established. I mean, of course, it's never established because you can always people go up and down, right? It's definitely one of those things. Yeah. But okay, some you know, with private tournaments, they also have the organizers kind of have some say in who gets invited. So
no, absolutely, absolutely.
That's a different question.
And you know, I'm sure if things sort of iron themselves out, or both parties, they put some effort into remediating the matter, I'm sure we will see Hans at the club back. But again, the effort has to be mutual, more or less. But yeah, that's the situation. Hikaru finals in the Open. You played Hikaru, I want to say, twice throughout the event. The first
once,
one you lost in blitz, right?
Yeah, I lost the first blitz game. Second game, I thought I did a good job of fighting back. And then in the time scramble, I just didn't find, I think they were like three pretty clear wins.
I remember that game. Yeah, that was a good one. That was
one was probably kind of easy. It was just to sacrifice the rook for the bishop and then to play knight to d3. But and it works with the king on g8. Not on g7, because on g7 he has like queen c2 and then knight to, or queen to b1. I remember where Wise King is. And then knight to b2, queen takes b2 is with check. But with the king on g8, there's no such thing. So I didn't realize that at the moment. I was also like getting that, we were both getting that mode where we were just kind of, you know, blitzing moves, which for him made sense. For me, it made a bit less sense because I, with 10 seconds, I maybe should have paused
for like a second. I don't think you had 10 seconds at that point. I'm pretty sure you
didn't.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe
seconds.
It was like oscillating between, you know, between 5 and 10 seconds. Maybe sometimes going down to 2. You know how this is, right? You get 2 seconds to move. Sometimes you go down to 2. You get scared, then you go up to 10. But you still never feel like you have much time. And yeah, and then there was like one very difficult moment, king to f8. I don't think this is realistic with no time. And then there was one other moment. But yeah, it was like kind of, there was one clear, very clear moment, which is to take on d1, play knight d3, which I think is possible to find, but also possible, like if you're looking out for this tactic and then it never works and then suddenly your king's on g8 and you don't realize it in the moment, can happen, of course. So, you know, I think this was a relatively normal, like, blitz mini match, which can go in different ways. Like, you know, against Levon, I played 2 blitz matches. Also, I kind of got by twice, but with some fortune each time. And then against Hikaru, it was the other way around. But, you know, I didn't have that. I don't know if you can call it luck. You can't really call it luck. You see a tactic in the critical moment or not, but it's a bit chancy. It's like some tactics you see, some you don't. And then, you know, it's, and of course, even if I won that game, it would just go to the second blitz match. So it's not like I guarantee a win. It just goes to another 2-game blitz match. But of course, I still stay alive. That's, I keep my chances alive. So, okay, this can happen. I wasn't too down on myself. I still had the life. I used the life. I beat Levon in the elimination finals, if you want to call it that, to get back to the grand finals. I think that's what they call it. This again against Hikaru, because he qualified to the grand finals by beating me. And this match was very regrettable. I think just, you know, losing the first game very unnecessarily. Very unnecessarily for sure, because it was at some point just a clean draw. And I don't know. I confuse myself in, in the last few seconds of the game, basically. But even getting to that point was already bad. Like there was a bunch of regrettable things in that game. One was to lose it, you know, when it was already a pretty clean draw. If I just start giving checks with my rook, which is not too difficult. But then previously to actually get into a difficult situation where I have to defend for a long time, that was also not great because then you're always going to be under pressure and things can go wrong. So, opening play, some decisions in the middle game.
I felt you had control in the middle game. Obviously, you were. I think one thing that can be improved is that you were thinking a lot and you got yourself down on time quite severely. I think that's just that should be avoidable, right? And especially when it comes to this time control, where you don't get the second time control after 40 moves, you're just in a perpetual time trouble, which is obviously a big problem. You need to make decisions along the way, and you need to make sometimes tough decisions with a few seconds on the clock, which is a lottery, right?
Yeah, because like let's say he played a line knight d2 followed by b3, which it's kind of known, but I couldn't remember exactly what to do. And my first instinct after a3 in the opening is to play rook to b8. It's like the first thing that comes to mind: rook b8, a b4, bishop b4, queen d3, e5. It's like literally the first variation that comes to mind, like within 2 seconds. And then I kind of convinced myself that knight takes e3, e takes d4, knight e4 looked a bit dangerous. Of course, this has been played before. It's some theory and it leads to equality. But you have the feeling like, okay, it's preparation. It looks a bit scary and looks tactical and things are hanging. I don't want to get into that. And if I had done that without being scared of the position after knight e4, which is really nothing, then I think the game just peters out to a draw, because this is it's actually what I would probably do in a blitz game and probably make a draw. But sometimes you overthink the opening a bit in a classical game because you know, in blitz, you feel like, okay, even if it goes a bit wrong in the opening, whatever, it's blitz and things will go out of control. So I'll always have chances. In classical, you really want to, or at least the feeling I think sometimes is that you really want to keep control. Like, okay, I know that this position is equal from the opening. Let's like clean it up. I can try to work things out. And then you might take some time. You play a move like bishop b7, as I did, thinking, okay, this is even cleaner. Then he plays knight e5. And then you realize that it's a bit unpleasant. He's still in preparation. It's a bit less pleasant than it was before, which is objectively true. It's still equal, but it's a bit less pleasant. Then probably I should play knight d5 quickly. It's my first instinct again. But it looked a bit scary, which is actually true. It's already getting a bit positionally scary, although it's the best decision. And then I decide to force matters with c2, thinking, okay, how bad can c2 be? He's still in preparation, so he blitzes out, take, 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 bishop b4, queen b2. And it turns out that this is a slightly unpleasant position. It's actually, you know, according to the engine's evaluation, it's like 0.3. Probably goes down once the engine starts to think for a very long time. But, you know, and he's still in preparation, so he's up time. He's won the opening battle, let's say. Then I play like a series of good moves and I've equalized. So like everything that happened after that, after my poor decision with bishop b7 followed by c2, from that moment until let's say, the moment when I play a5, then it's every decision I make is good. And even the time usage, I think, was pretty good.
Yeah.
Like I took time to play bishop b7. It was a good time usage because that was a good move. Not to get into real trouble. But I have 15 minutes and it's in equal position. I mean, I don't think it's because of time management. You know, I can hold this position, maybe with 1 minute on my clock.
At that point, it felt simple enough.
And then I play a5, which is a slightly silly. I mean, it just makes my life a bit more difficult. You know, if I just play king f8, e7, my pawn on a6 is better than a5. So then I play a5, then I play bishop a6, which is not, I think, the best solution, probably bishop g6. I'd regret a bishop a6 quite a bit after I played it. And then I play this incredibly careless move, king to e7. I don't know why I didn't like stop and think. Yeah. It's basically a losing move, like, or borderline losing move. Like if I stop and think here, I probably can still keep the game. It's not very pleasant, but I can probably still keep it pretty under control by just not putting my king on e7. The point being that after rook c6, I need to play bishop b7. I really need to get bishop d5. After king e7, rook c6, suddenly it's like huge problems because bishop b7 loses a piece. And king d7, rook c5, bishop b7, knight c4 loses a pawn, if not more at that point. And losing a pawn, then that's when you're in real trouble, because now it's not, you know, now you basically have to hold a pawn down position forever. Like it's, you know, you don't hold this, in a systematic way. It's like maybe dynamically you can hold it after a long defense, which is sort of what I ended
that's
up trying to do.
That's basically what happened. Yeah. Like he gave you some dynamic chances and you took them.
Yeah. And then it was a draw. So, and then, you know, but of course it's not ideal to put yourself in that situation where you have 2 minutes and you have to find one path to a draw. I think in this case, it wasn't too difficult, the path. So I should have found it, but still it was a series of like small things. And then I think two big moments, king to e7. But that's a pretty bad mistake. It's like, I don't know. What am I thinking for a second? You know, like what's going through my mind? I'm not
did you
sure.
realize it once you played?
I mean, of course, yeah, king e7, rook
so
c6.
So immediately
and,
after
and,
you played it, you
like,
realized
it's
yeah.
really stupid. Like it was just a complete lapse of concentration. King e7 is an incredibly serious blunder, I think.
Yeah.
And okay, then I pulled myself together. I found king f6, which was necessary. E4 by him was a pretty bad decision, I think. And then he let me back into the game. His technique was also not really like the best for a while. He really did allow me to get back into the game fully, but I should have taken that chance. Yeah, it's, again, like I think my concentration slipped because like for whatever reason, I'm just like surprised by king d1. Like, okay, I thought the game's over. I held the game and then suddenly king d1 and I have to solve problems again. But basically I should have been thinking on my own time, like, okay, what's his last chance to try to win this game before he played knight b1? I saw knight b1. It was an option. I just thought, okay, I give check. And then I realized that it's not so simple. My bishop is trapped. But I don't know why I didn't just consider that I play like, yeah, let's say after king d1, I attack his g3 pawn. He plays knight to d2. I take the pawn. And he plays rook to a7, and now I just need to start giving checks. And then my g-pawn becomes a very important force in many lines, which I was even thinking about isn't in a general point of view, but I just didn't consider rook g1. Like, I don't know. I just thought, okay, rook g1, king e2, and it's not helping me, but it actually does help me. And it's not a very difficult calculation.
For what it's worth, I was watching, obviously, I was doing commentary on the games, and we were all doing commentary on the games. And none of us in the studio found it without the help of the engine. Like sometimes I don't look at the engine. I just try to solve things myself, especially in time travel. And that was one those times I was seeing that the engine was saying zeros, and I just couldn't understand why. And then obviously you realize that you have this idea with G3 and just a simple, let's say G3. But yeah, in my opinion, it's not that simple, especially because you have other options like you played right in the game. Like you have a bunch of options and you have
option
to choose
very bad. It was just panicky.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause it really does look bad. You know, rook, like I'm not taking the G3 pawn. This is kind of what I'm should be taking.
Right. Right.
So yeah, it was, I really don't think this was a super difficult moment. I think it's a bit confusing. It can go wrong, of course.
Right.
But with like 3 minutes on the clock, I mean, maybe with, you know, if you're playing like a blitz game, okay, you probably don't find it. You know, if you're, you might find it by luck. Yeah. But if you're like on a 10-second increment or something, then I understand if someone doesn't find it. If you're on a 30-second increment with 3 minutes, really, I think should be found. Mm-hmm. Really should be found. So, and the second game, again, I think I didn't really play well. I mean, okay, it didn't put much pressure. But yeah, it did feel like my classical play throughout the tournament was just off.
The rapid was good.
Oh, I only played two rapid games. I wouldn't say blitz was good overall.
Rapid and blitz, yeah. Like in the elimination bracket, I think you did some good damage, especially against Levon. Like you were playing Levon quite a few times.
No, but like when I look back on it, although I got to the final, I think my match against Ray in classical was not very good. In blitz was not very good. It's just a bit lucky against Levon in classical. not the worst, you know, but okay, getting in trouble in the second game so unnecessarily when he just wanted a draw, basically. He was just trying to make a draw from the opening. Was like so, yeah, so shaky. And then with White, I actually thought it was a pretty fun game. It was a very difficult game, but one of the, probably the best game I played in classical there. Against Hikaru, the classical games in the first match were kind of non-eventful. But with White, not very, I mean, not spectacular at all. Like overall, I would say my classical was at a pretty, either from uninspired to just poor, like between that range, uninspired and poor, somewhere in the middle. And
is it also because of the format? Because this felt like throughout the event was a problem in classical. Not a lot of people and not a lot of players were taking risks, especially in the open. Like in the women's, we've seen some decisive results. In the open, I think we've seen two decisive results in the whole tournament, which was a bit underwhelming, right?
It happens. Yeah.
But it must be because of the format, right?
Yeah, I would say that in general, like classical, when you have players who are quite high level, pretty solid and solid openings, and they don't want to take too many risks, you're going to see a relatively high draw rate. I mean, and two game match, people don't want to take too many risks. On the other hand, if I look to my games, like, okay, against Ray in the first game, of course, I should win this. One way or another, I should win this game. And against Levon with White, you know, it could, okay, I wouldn't say I was like close to winning. There was one moment in that game where objectively I was very close to winning, but it's only from like a computer point of view. It's like if, not in the end game was always kind of drawish, but, I had this moment when I could have played g5 after knight c5. And it's a really crazy position, but the engine really likes this moment for White. But okay, to say that this is like a winning opportunity, you know, it's a complete mess, which engine would probably win against another engine. And then, yeah, if I had drawn against Hikaru in the first game, maybe we would have just seen all draws in my games, which would be pretty good considering my quality. I wouldn't complain too much. But to lose that game, yeah, overall, of course, I think like this year in classical chess, I've played really poorly for whatever reason. And I've kind of gotten by on Rapid and Blitz because now Rapid and Blitz is just so prevalent. Like, I mean, how many matches this year I won based on like Rapid and Blitz, like against Sindarov.
Even in chess 960, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
it's not even classical chess.
Yeah. Okay. The Champion Showdown, I could say that if you consider that classical, then I played well in classical. I don't know if you consider it classical or semi-classical, whatever, but that was about the only time that I felt good about my like long. It's been a while. Yeah. It's really been a while. So I am hoping to get back to some classical form.
Do you feel most players are having this type of thoughts and this type of experience when it comes to playing all these different events with different time controls and having to adjust from one tournament to the other or from one game to the other when you have?
No, I don't think most players are. I think some players, I don't know, like for Hikaru, I think it's one of his, in general, better years from classical point of view.
I think
like his classical is very stable and he's kind of found a way to make it work for him in classical. And I don't know. I think in general, in Rapid and Blitz, he's probably not as strong as he used to be. But in classical, he's definitely like found some sort of groove that works for him very, very well.
Yeah, no,
and,
I mean,
this is for a guy like, let's say, Gukesh, obviously classical is the main thing.
Yeah, yeah. And this is what he said also in the interview before the event when I asked him which one he feels the strongest about. He said he's classical. And this is kind of what prompted his whole retirement statement, right? He was losing a lot of steam in those last few seconds in the blitz in freestyle. So that kind of was the trigger. But yeah, he's maintaining a very decent balance between classical and rapid and blitz so far. So it's working for him. Now, speaking of Hikaru, because he also had, unrelated to the tournament, quite an interesting statement. which gathered some steam on the socials. He said that the candidates, winning the candidates is basically a lottery. And he mentioned that some of the players won the tournament too few times. I think he gave your name as an example. And some have been quite successful, like Nepo and Anand. But he also said that you have very little control over the standings because very few games pretty much determine who's going to be the winner. And it's also because sometimes people check out. So, and you know, it's based on how well you do against people that check out in general. Do you feel that's the same way?
Well, first of all, I think that the word lottery is a bit of a, it's going to be a term that's interpreted differently by different people. So if you tell me it's a lottery, I would say, yeah, that doesn't really make sense to me because obviously it's not a lottery. I mean, you can't put like a 2,500 will have zero chance, right? I think in general, well, like, let's say he says that I have won it few times, probably based on how he sees my strength. I've won it one out of five times, which is 20%.
Right.
And if we consider all players and candidates to have equal, then each player will have a 12.5% chance, which obviously not every player has an equal chance.
But then Nepo has won it two out of three, for example, right?
Yeah, sure. He's won it two out of three, which is, I mean, it's very good.
Also, Anand did very, very well.
Well, again, what are we considering the candidates? Because do we consider 2007 a candidate? It was a world championship, right? Not a candidate. So I guess we don't consider that a candidate.
Not that one.
It's the same. So then he's won it in 2014. He didn't win in 2016. And when else did he play? Like, it's such a small data set. I don't know.
Yeah, if we're counting, he has like 50%. Yeah, that's not, but that's
he only,
not that much.
He only played twice. I mean, then if you stopped when I played, when I won, then I would also be 50%.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's like also Karjakin, right? He won it, what, one out of three that he played in? That's really good odds. But yeah, if Karjakin had played two more times, most likely he wouldn't have won it. I mean, maybe he would have. We can't. But chances are how we would rate chances. Let's say we determine that Karjakin has a, you know, by his rating, 15%, 20% chance in a candidate, then he's probably not going to win it in two tries. Jan won it twice in his first two tries, but that is obviously an outlier. That is, again, a small data set. And, you know, there will also be players who haven't won it, even despite playing it many times and despite having a chance, like, for example, Levon. But again, that could be considered an outlier. You know, you would expect maybe out of like six times that he's played, that he would have won once, but it just didn't happen. So in that sense, I would say that like most tournaments are, the way that I would interpret Hikaru's words are a lottery because you don't really have high chances in many tournaments, but it's just that you don't think about it because it's like, oh, I didn't win Norway chess. Okay, I'll try again next year. What's the big deal? Like, it doesn't change my career. And then I play the US championship and I win that. Or I play Bucharest, I win that. So yeah, I didn't win one, I won the other. It doesn't, the difference with the candidates is that if I don't win the candidates and then I win like four super tournaments in a row, that's not the same as winning the candidates and then winning zero super tournaments after that, because the candidates is vastly more important to the point that you win six super tournaments after that and it's still not as important as winning the candidates.
Yep.
And so maybe he views it as a lottery because it's like you have a small chance, but okay, let's say you have a 20% chance. You probably also have a 20% chance in Norway chess or any other, you know, just pick a tournament, right? But it doesn't really feel like a big deal if you don't win Bucharest Grand Chess Tour, you don't win the Singfield Cup, or you don't win, you know, Tata Steel.
There's disproportionate weight added to the tournament.
Yeah, and it's just like we go on to the next one. It's the same value as any other tournament. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Big deal. We've played a million of these tournaments. We've won some. We've not won others, and it doesn't sting too much to not win it. You know, the candidates is once every 2 years, and the prize is potentially becoming world champion. So it's it's definitely not a lottery. Now, in terms of like, there are certain players who maybe you have to beat up on because they're a bit of on the weaker side, right? Compared to the rest of the field.
Well, not necessarily on the weaker side. Sure, that is the case as well with some players, but he was mentioning that some people just simply check out. Once they understand they don't have a chance to win it, they check out, and then winning the tournament is based on how well you do against those type of players.
But this is literally the case in every tournament. You know, the end of Tata Steel, some players
sort
are tilted.
Of, yes, yes.
And yeah, you can play someone at the wrong day. He had a great day, or you can play him at the right day. It could be like playing an entirely different person. And it could change the tournament from, you know, average to victory.
So if that's the case, how would you feel about changing the format from an 8-player double round robin to an elimination format?
I mean, that also has like high variance and also has what you would call luck factors. Now, luck factors, they don't mean it's a lottery. It just means that there is an element of chance in everything. Again, the difference is that in the candidates, you feel it. If I just have like an unlucky, like let's say I get caught in preparation in the last round of a super tournament and, you know, just, or let's say I come up with some brilliant preparation, but my opponent finds all the moves. It's, you know, very unexpected. It's one of the most difficult tasks that they could come up with. They had like a very low chance of kind of going through these complications. They find everything correctly and I don't win the game despite, you know, coming up with a great idea. Doesn't feel like, okay, you know, we would typically say, and you've heard chess players say it all the time, okay, bad luck. It's not a big deal, right? Sometimes you have some bad luck. Sometimes you have some good luck. Sometimes my opponent plays like an idiot, despite being a great player. Sometimes they play like a genius and I can't do anything about it. And if it happens in the candidates, you just feel it more acutely. And then you think, it's, you know, such a lottery, right? But that's not, it's just normal. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
And in a knockout format, you have the same exact thing. Like you just had, let's say you're the best player in the world. So 360 days a year, you play better than anyone. And for 4 days of a certain match, you just have an off patch and you play worse and you lose to someone who is extremely capable and pounces on the slightest bit of weakness. It's bad luck, right? It's the same thing. I mean, you're going to have some potential bad luck. Just, you know, you're in wrong form at the wrong moment. Or you're in good form at the good moment.
That's, which felt to be the case with Nepo, very often during the candidates, right? Like he was more or less, you know, around the 2780 plus level throughout the year, but nothing spectacular. And then during the candidates, he had a style that was a force, right?
No, look, okay, so I'll give my, I have thought about this then. So first of all, 2780 is, of course, spectacular. It's right. Like five people in the world out of 8 billion people, right?
But he wasn't really winning any tournaments. Like he was staying above that rating without winning any big tournaments.
Or sure. Before the 2020 candidates, he was not considered a favorite. But he was capable. He definitely had a chance. Whatever we want to put his chance at before the tournament. Maybe it's 15% based on his rating at the time.
Yeah.
Slightly better than average because there's 8 players. There was a player like Alexienko. Probably we would give him a quite minimal chance because he was 2696 at the time. Probably by the numbers, pretty minimal chance to win.
Right. Right.
So as we know, Jan did win this tournament and quite convincingly. He lost in the last round, but still won the tournament because the last round didn't matter. So what does this mean? Now, was it because his preparation was great? Maybe his preparation was great. Maybe there were some factors that were a bit circumstantial. Like in this case, we can actually point to something that was kind of unusual. The fact that the tournament did pause midway and did pause in a moment when I think objectively we have to say it's most likely to be beneficial to him after he lost a game to Maxim Bashvilugrov.
Absolutely.
And was definitely a poor moment for Maxim because the very next round he played me. And it was definitely more dangerous for him after a year that I could.
You had some time to cook.
Like as we saw by the results, obviously the amount of preparation I did help me to win that game and to to separate Maxime from Jan. Now, this is definitely a moment we can say circumstance worked in his favor. But there are going to be less obvious moments when circumstances could work in someone's favor, right? It would just be like, it wouldn't be so obvious. It would just be like, okay, I didn't sleep too well the night before. We can't really see this, but it can lead to a player who's in the lead, you know, or my opponent, for whatever reason, was just super inspired, knew the position very well, was just playing in flow, and everything worked out. I'll give, just so people don't think I'm like super biased. In 2018, when I won the candidates, I had a moment of, I would consider it very good luck. That's just what I call it. You can call it something else. After I lost to Karakin in the 12th round, there was a rest day, and then I had to play Levon Aronian. There are two rounds left. I'm tied with Karakin, tied, I think, with Mamedyarov.
I think Mamedyarov was there as well, yeah. I'm not sure if Ding was...
But my tiebreaks are bad because I lost to Karakin. This right. means my tiebreaks are bad, and there's no playoff at the time.
I need to
score more than Karakin in the last two rounds. Pretty difficult task because it's two games. One game is going to be with Black, which you can't really count on a win. And I can't count on Karakin losing a game. So I basically have to win my next game. I considered it a must win.
Yep.
So I'm playing Levon. He's having a very poor tournament. This is already like maybe luck factor number one, that I'm playing a guy who is having a poor tournament and doesn't really care too much. He's just kind of dejected. It's a bit different than if you play someone who's having a poor tournament in like the Grand Chess Tour. It's like, okay, Grand Chess Tour, I have something to look forward to. You know, I'm minus one, but maybe if I score 50%, then that gives me a better chance.
You might be fighting for some prizes, right?
Yeah,
for
right?
some money.
So candidates, he's fighting for nothing. And he knows that for the next 2 years, he won't fight for the world championship title. He is extremely dejected. So I'm playing someone who's in just a bad state of mind. That's helpful to me. And then what's the second piece of luck? He plays two openings at the time. He plays the Berlin. He plays the Marshall. He plays them kind of 50-50. Now, it just so happened that I had a pretty good idea of what I would do in the Marshall, and I had absolutely no idea what I would do against the Berlin. Literally before the game, I'm just praying. I'm like, okay, if he plays the Marshall, at least I have something in mind there, something to play. If he plays the Berlin, I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, I did have something that I would do, but I wasn't very confident about it. He plays the Marshall. It was a 50-50 from my point of view. I mean, from his, of course, he knew what he was going to play. And I came up with my idea. I got a huge advantage from the opening. And although it wasn't smooth from then on, I did win the game. And I won the tournament because of that game, mostly because of that game. Now, for me, that's luck, you know, because I can just say that, like, let's say if we run 100 simulations, maybe I win, you know, 35. Maybe I win 40. But it turned out that things worked out in my favor. But it's not just luck. It's like you also have to be in that position. Like you, let's say, you know, before the last round of the last candidates, Gukesh had a certain percentage, very high, of winning a tournament. I had a certain percentage, lower, but still not bad. Jan had a pretty low percentage because he was playing black against me. Hikaru had a certain percentage, whatever that was, and nobody else had a chance. And, you know, things could have happened in a lot of different ways. Now, I can't say it's bad luck that I screwed up a winning position against Jan. Jan could perhaps say it's bad luck that he was leading the whole tournament and then suddenly Gukesh wins this game against Ferrugia and separates from the pack in the penultimate round. Sure. But a lot of this is kind of circumstantial. It's just, okay, it's what it is. You have a lot of really strong players. They all have a certain chance of winning. And then circumstances kind of separate them throughout the tournament. And some other things, skills, circumstances, it's a lot of factors. It's not a lottery. That's just how chess is. That's how sports are.
Yep.
I mean, you have a 100-meter dash and then it's separated with, you know, milliseconds. I mean, it's not that like one guy is dominant and everyone else is an idiot, right? Just that, there's skill, but everyone's skilled. Everyone is extremely skilled. And then there are some circumstances that decide the rest.
Yeah, no, that makes sports. A lot of sense the way you described it. it doesn't seem like lottery to me. And I sort of tend to agree with you. I understand where Hikaru is coming from, but I don't think that any tournament can be attributed only to luck and only to lottery. So the whole premise of his whole idea is sort of set in the wrong place. Now, let's continue, because a lot of things have happened in the past week or so.
I'll just add one thing. You have something. There is an element of that we are like set, you know, putting everything in one basket of one tournament. I don't know how to fix that. You could have like a tour throughout the year. Maybe it's just another idea. But the way it is set up, of course, everything is like put in the candidates. It's a, you know, you could win every tournament throughout the year, but you know, the candidates is
and
the
it's
one
every
that,
2 years, yeah, which adds to the prestige and to the pressure.
I mean, whoever wins the candidates is hugely deserving of it because it is so difficult to win. But there could be like players who perform super, super well in the rest of the year, and then they're kind of left a bit in the dust. This can happen. I don't know if there's a solution to this. I mean, I think there's definitely some potential system that could be considered, which wouldn't, I don't know if it would be better, but it would have some merit, like let's say having a tour throughout the year. But it's also no system would be perfect.
How do you feel about the length of the tenure of the world champion? 2 years. Do you feel it should be 1 year? Or longer?
I mean,
Just have candidates every single year, could you fit the entire qualification
in 1 year? That's the only thing. Like, you have to fit the qualification for the candidates.
You would have to change.
Then the candidates.
You
would have to change. Then the match.
Yeah. It would have to change, obviously.
I think the only way to like do that would be to just take the rating list, like top eight, and then just take away the whole qualification. But that's not, I'm not saying that should be the case, but if you wanted to like shorten it, I don't know how else you would do it. Or to have like the World Cup and then the World Cup at the start of the year, like maybe two World Cups at the start of the year, and then the candidates mid-year, and then World Championship ending.
Right.
Like you have one World Cup, Final Four qualify, another World Cup, Final Four qualify, and then candidates, eight players, and then World Championship. Like, but it would be really tight, and you would lose some democracy in terms of giving everyone a chance of qualifying, because and also the World Cup format, people will say it's a bit of a crapshoot too. So it's, you're not going to please everyone.
Right, right. Yeah, it's an imperfect system and it cannot be perfect, basically. You're always going
to be. Nothing's perfect.
Yeah, nothing's perfect.
To decide
especially
who's the
not
most,
in this regard.
Who is the strongest. Also, the thing with chess is that we have like 85,000 different formats of chess. I mean, just to give you an idea, the first event I played this year, it's classical with a certain time control. Then I played Fischer Random, totally different type of chess. First rapid, then classical, then rapid again, then blitz, and then Armageddon. So I'm playing five different formats within a format that is played only recently for Fischer Random, freestyle. Then I played an online event, the Champions Chess Tour, with no increment, which is a totally different format, and it's not even played on a chessboard anymore. Now it's on a computer. And then I played the Champions Showdown, which is now a time control I've never played, semi-rapid, followed by rapid, followed by blitz, without even a scoring system. Then I played the American Cup, which is a different form of classical. Now it's 90-30, different time control entirely, followed by blitz immediately, followed by Armageddon. And then if you lose a match, then it's rapid followed by blitz. And then you can again play classical. So it's like the time control changes every day, every hour. I mean,
I say this as a feature. I don't think this is a bug. I don't have anything against it. I sort of like it.
But it is really weird.
It's weird for the players. Yes.
I imagine a runner who is literally like first, okay, you're going to run 100 meters. And if it's tied, then suddenly you run 23 meters. And now, and then tomorrow you'll, you know, do a marathon.
I can give you examples of sports, that sort of do the same thing. Like, for example, jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu is exactly the same. You can do it with a kimono on. You can do it without a kimono on. You can have time of the rounds, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever. Basically, the organizer chooses. Then you have different ways of scoring. Sometimes it's based on scores. Sometimes it's based on submission only. So the match can last hours as long as nobody submits anybody. Basically, you have a bunch of different styles and a bunch of different scoring systems within the same sport. And it almost feels sometimes like different sports, like whenever you put a kimono on or whenever you do it without the kimono on, without the gi. It's basically like the difference between classical and rapid, more or less. It feels okay, like a different sport almost.
I don't know much about jiu-jitsu, but I would just venture a guess that there are a lot of different people who in like a short time period have been considered the best in jiu-jitsu because of this.
Yes. 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 It sort of
changes. It's not a bad thing. Just, you know, it's part of like having an ever-changing format.
Well, also the best players in with a kimono, for example, are not the best players without the kimono. Like not even close. Like it almost feels like two different sports.
Actually, in chess, it is kind of remarkable that we have a player who has excelled throughout. I mean, in general, top players do excel, but there's some like specializing, right? It's like
There definitely is specializing.
There's some specializing, but we have one player who has excelled as the best in throughout the different formats. With some like, okay, let's say Magnus has not excelled as a clear best in bullet, but bullet is like something else entirely, right?
But he's pretty much
he's still really good, obviously, but he's
one of the top guys, you know.
You wouldn't say that he's the number one bullet player in the world. You might say he's like top three,
right?
But I wouldn't say number one.
It's unclear, right? Any day can be somebody else, like Hikaru or even Andrew Tang or something. Okay, depends
also,
on where
you
play.
Also, do you feel like online chess? Yeah, well, I don't know about Andrew Tang. I think it's like
if you play on chess, good luck.
Okay, but this is like. This is an entirely different thing. I mean, this is the for me, the weird thing about online chess is that it really does depend in some ways with like connection speed sometimes and mouse speed and things that are not really chess related.
100%. 100%.
Especially in bullet. I was actually looking, this is the weirdest thing. I just saw that, you know, this very talented American kid, Andy Woodward, who I think is like 25, 50 plus at the age of 14. So he's very talented. He reaches a bullet rating of like, I don't know, 34
something. Yeah. Yeah.
Something ridiculous. And then I like look at the games and I think he was playing like 10 second chess, which is already okay. I mean, it's already pretty funny.
That's a lot.
And then it's like his opponent plays A6, Rook A7, A8 the entire game for like 140 moves. It's like they're playing 10 second chess, 140 moves. And then he plays something like A4, Rook A3, Rook B3, C3, et cetera. The rook just goes along and then A5. And then the rook goes along and then B4, B5 until at some point all of white's pawns are on the like sixth rank. And then for the next like 80 moves, white doesn't checkmate in one move. and then at some point they flag it was something along these lines. So for me, bullet is a bit of a, I mean, I used to play a lot on ICC, but it's a bit of a silly idea.
Cool. All right. Moving on to the hot topics of the week. Let's start with the big one. Shevchenko. The case of the famous Kirill Shevchenko, Ukrainian player, probably the top player that ever got banned for cheating. I believe right now he's number 75 on the live rating list or something very high. A player that was close to 2700, around 2650 nowadays, but still very, very high. He was banned for presumably hiding a cell phone or multiple cell phones in the bathroom of the event and going into the bathroom to check it during the game. Now, there was an investigation. Apparently, he cooperated with it. He acknowledged the fact that he was using that phone, and he also said that he did not cheat or he did not get to cheat because he got caught. Now, after a pretty thorough investigation, he got 3 years suspension. He gets to keep his title, which is a bit unusual. In the past, there's been cases most GMs that have been cheated and have been caught cheating have had their title removed. Now, he gets to keep the title. He gets 3 years, and one of those years is with suspension. So he's basically going to be able to start playing in October 2026. Your first take on that.
Okay, so I have the article here. So the first thing is that it is not really in question that he was cheating.
He was cheating.
I mean, I think that already pretty clear, but basically he also admitted to it, to the best of my understanding, right? But I don't understand what this language is. It says that he did not effectively cheat. I don't know what that means. It's like you cheated, but you didn't win the game. It means you effectively didn't cheat or whatever. If you have any access to outside information during the game, you cheated. Even if you, for whatever reason, don't choose to play the move that the engine suggested, if you have any information from an outside source, you've cheated.
My understanding is that he did not get to make his moves after he looked at his phone.
What does that mean? He didn't get to make his moves.
I think the game was he got caught in the middle of the game, and then he basically got thrown out of the tournament with the game.
Wait, but his game against Paco Vallejo, he sent an email admitting that he used a mobile phone during the game against Paco Vallejo. That game was completed, right? Well, he won the game. So again, to say I didn't effectively cheat, I don't know what that means. You cheated, you saw what the engine says, and you won the game. Even if you didn't win, you still cheated. Even if you lost.
Oh yeah.
You still cheated.
If you lost,
you just look a bit more silly for cheating and losing, but you still cheated. I mean, if you get any outside information, and there are degrees to which it's bad. Like, let's say if my friend whispers a move to me during the game, that's bad. It's still not as bad as an engine, because at least like a human is fallible and can suggest a bad move. And an engine just gives you the answer. So it's like, you don't even have to think about it. But still, there are degrees, but cheating is cheating. Now, his degree was the worst. He used an engine which just tells you the answers. And it actually doesn't matter if let's say I didn't effectively cheat because I decided to not play the first line of the engine. It doesn't matter, because it still helps you with the evaluation, and you know that the move you played is the second line and you have information, whatever. Besides the fact that from, like, let's say a spiritual point of view, none of this matters. I mean, you cheat, you cheat.
No. It's pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious. If he did use it during the game against Paco, then obviously he cheated. The language doesn't make any sense. It's just lawyer language at that point.
So that part I just discount.
I thought the first time that he got caught is the first time that he cheated, and the game was pretty much annulled.
I only cheated during the game I drew, I would also be very skeptical, because it's very common for someone who's caught to say, okay, I did it, but only this one time. And that's usually not true, right? I did it, but you did it, and you probably did it more. If you did it once, you probably did it more. Although I'm not going to speculate too much, like how much, but anyway, he admitted to cheating in a game he won. Now that's basically the end of it for me. He denies that his actions had any influence on his games. Again, yeah, it does have influence. You can deny it all you want. You saw something from outside. It had all the influence in the world, because it changes your entire perception of the game. It's cheating. So then, according to analysis by Kenneth Reagan, American professor and expert on chess cheating, there was no standard deviation of the player's performance in this tournament from his typical performance rating. I'll respond to this, although I'm not a mathematician, and Kenneth Reagan is, and I don't know much about statistics, but the first thought I would have is that it might not have standard deviation from his rating, which was achieved perhaps. I don't know, but if someone has cheated, then their rating is called into question in the first place. So that data point might already be corrupted, right? And also my other thing would be if we know that someone has cheated and your analysis says, I couldn't find them cheating, then it might be an issue with your analysis, right? That's other thing, because we actually know, like they admitted to it. So, that might just be a sign that you're not effectively determining from their moves that they did do what they admitted they did. And then the question is about the sentence, right? That's the main question.
Yeah, that's a big question. So I think the Ethics and Disciplinary Commission gave him 2 years, 3 years, one of them being suspended. And the Fair Play Commission, FIDE's Fair Play Commission, is not very happy with that. A lot of people are not very happy with that, thinking that it's too lenient. My understanding is that it's, well, I guess my, the way I see it, it's too lenient. He should have gotten more. It's an existential threat. We cannot treat it like, okay, you cheat. Who knows how much you cheated? Who knows for how many games you cheated? You got caught and now you get only 2 years. It feels a bit lenient. I understand the circumstances. I think he was saying that he had mental health problems. He was receiving threats, which is obviously impactful and a big problem. And I'm sure it affected him in a certain way and perhaps influenced his decision to cheat as well. But
yeah, I don't as a really sport, understand we cannot give him why, 2 years. I mean, I saw this bit. Like, why was he receiving death threats? I mean, obviously that's horrible.
This is
but
probably related to the war in Ukraine. So obviously there's...
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously horrible. Like if your family is potentially in danger,
yeah,
because no, there's a war in your country. I mean, I'm very sympathetic. That's that would affect anyone. I mean, I can really sympathize with that he wasn't in a good mental place for reasons which are fair, you know.
Absolutely,
that's basically the worst thing that can happen, right? That you're afraid of your family's 100%. Safety.
100%. Yeah.
Still, death threats to me is like kind of surprising, but they say they saw video evidence that he was receiving death threats.
It seems to be credible. Yes, it seems to be credible.
It's really, really bad that he had to go through that. And it's like I can personally forgive. I mean, it's not even my place really to forgive, but that's someone like it. You know, we all make mistakes. He did something stupid. Maybe while he was in a tough spot. And I can sympathize with that, but it's still a general issue in chess. And then if we're just like very understanding all the time,
it's a huge problem. I cannot.
It does create a problem for chess. So you have to kind of balance that out. Like, I don't want to be super harsh on someone who maybe doesn't deserve real harshness. Like maybe he doesn't deserve that maybe he's a good guy and
two or
whatever,
too low.
And, you know, just think, right?
Yeah.
But still, it's like we do have to protect the sport, and we can't consider every case like, okay, there was this reason, there was that reason. So yeah, I don't know. It is a tough one for sure, because I don't think that he would probably cheat again. But still, we can't make it so that there's no punishment for cheating, because it has to also be a deterrent, right?
Yeah.
And it's not like you're necessarily ruining someone's life. I mean, you can't play chess. Okay. It's kind of the price you pay for violating the rules of the sport and the sanctity of the sport. I am somewhat sympathetic, because I'm like reasonably certain that cheating goes on a lot, at least online. And for me, there is no real distinction between online cheating or the board cheating. I think it's the same seriousness. And the difference is that online, you're less likely to get caught, because you can't really, you know, in this case, they caught him because and only because there was hard evidence, right? There was a phone. And online, you don't really have that. You don't have a smoking gun. It's usually based on some data and looking for patterns that don't make sense. And in this case, we saw that they actually wouldn't have caught him with the data they had, because they determined he there was no deviation, right? But the way they caught him was with hard evidence, which you don't get online. And I think it's a bit unfair in some, well, not unfair. It's a bit unfair. I don't know if that's the right word, but that someone is punished very harshly for something that a lot of people are doing with no punishment and perhaps winning more money while they do it, than he did. On the other hand, yeah, if you cheat, then you kind of deserve it. And,
so the moral of the story is don't get caught.
Yeah. No, I mean, you have to set a precedent. That's, well, we kind of did set a precedent, but now it's a bit weird to me. It's like Rousis got banned for, how long was Rousis banned for?
I want to say 5 years, but he also got stripped of his title.
I mean,
he got stripped of his title, like Nikolidze as well. Like Nikolidze got stripped of his title as well. So the precedent was set that you get caught like that, red-handed, you get stripped of your title. He didn't. And also like larger punishments.
Okay, 6 year ban.
Six years. Yeah. I don't know how much Nikolidze got, but I would assume somewhere around there. Yeah. 2 years just feels too lenient to me. I would expect 5 years at least. You don't want to take his title because it's first time offense and
obviously 3 years.
Only 3 years. Okay. Nikolidze only got 3 years. That's interesting.
Now to me, it's like, okay, I understand that Shevchenko is a strong grandmaster. So it would also be like, he did achieve his grandmaster title in a legitimate way. I don't know this for sure, but
I mean, you've played him in the Grand Chess Tour. Yeah. He's not a bad player.
A few games. Yeah. But of course he was a strong grandmaster, 2600 plus grandmaster, maybe even high 2600 strength. I don't know the extent of how much he was cheating, but definitely a strong 26 plus grandmaster. And probably 2650 plus. Let's just say that that's very likely the case, that he was a 2650 plus, top 100 in the world. On the other hand, Rousis was also legitimately achieved his grandmaster title. I like, if I were in charge of this, I wouldn't revoke a title because unless it was determined that this title was achieved through these unfair means, I would say, okay, we have to kind of find an appropriate punishment. And also, in case this is like a serial cheater, protect our sport in some way. And a 5 year ban does feel reasonable. Now in this case, it's a 3 year ban, but 1 year for some reason is suspended and they already consider time served, which, again, to me, it's like, okay, he was free to play, right? Wasn't he? Or
no, I don't think so. No. He was.
Okay, in that case, maybe it makes sense.
He was on a 75-day ban in between.
The 1 year suspended is a bit. Like, one thing that kind of came to mind for me is that I've worked with players who have changed federations and they weren't able to play because of that.
For 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, they weren't able to play the World Cup, for example.
Big events for 2 years. I mean, it's crazy. I understand.
Unless you pay some, like, let's say I worked with Lanier, right? He was a 2750 player. He changed federations. He couldn't play in like the official FIDE tournaments, like let's say the World Cup, the World Championship cycle. And effectively he didn't play for quite a while. His career got paused for that period of time, despite, of course, that he did nothing wrong. And it does feel like this is the same situation, except one person was cheating and one person did absolutely nothing wrong. But they still more or less got a pause on their career for this period of like, you know, about 2 years.
Yeah.
Like August of 2026 is really, I mean, okay.
It's not far.
For me,
October.
Time goes very fast. Yeah. It doesn't feel like that far away.
October 2026, but yes.
October, you said?
Yeah, I think it's October.
Okay. I mean, the Grand Chess Tour happens this year. The Grand Chess Tour happens next year. So we're there. Like, I think if I decided to not play chess until October of 2026, obviously I would miss out on the candidates. It wouldn't be great. But for someone who's not playing the candidates, I don't know, would it change your career so drastically? you'd miss out on money for a while.
He's not allowed to play. He's not allowed to play anything, right? Like, he's not allowed to play any open tournaments. He's not allowed to play pretty much anything at this point. Any FIDE events, I would assume anything that's sanctioned even by, not by FIDE, like US chess, sure. Even if it's like a US chess, I would assume he's not allowed to play. But I don't know.
I mean, I don't even know. Would they notice that?
Somebody would notice.
He played like some small opens in, you know, somewhere in Kansas.
Somebody definitely will notice.
I'm kind of sympathetic in some ways. I'm generally feel like pretty forgiving if someone is very remorseful about something, but okay, we do have to also protect the sport. It's difficult. It's a real issue in the sport. I mean, you know, what can you do? Nobody's happy about the whole thing. So, yeah, I feel like the ban is pretty lenient considering. But I do hope that when he comes back, that, he'll integrate into chess and not have to resort to cheating.
Most people don't. Most people, once they get banned, like the case of Feller, I think Nicolizzi, I've never seen him back. Raus, he's obviously gave up, and,
Raus has passed away.
Unfortunately passed after that, but he basically said that he's done with chess. Like, immediately after he got caught, he said that he's done with chess. So most people don't get reintegrated. There's obviously a stain, and it's going to be very difficult for him to come back. Even socially, you know, like socially get back, and once you're an admitted cheater. So yeah, that's obviously.
Trust me, there are a lot of not admitted cheaters out there.
I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are. As long as you deny, and as long as you don't get caught, you might be able to hang around for a while. So that's the situation with Shevchenko. Obviously, 2 years seems too lenient. Another big story was that of Ekaterina Lachno withdrawing from the Grand Prix, from the Women's Grand Prix, I believe just before the final event. And this was for a reason that somewhat shocked me. She basically accused the organizers of the previous Grand Prix of bias because they didn't award her the most beautiful game title, which she might be entitled, but also it's subjective, and also it's one of those reasons that you're not even thinking about. It's one of those titles that you get awarded at the end as a bonus, and it's like, yeah, sure, you know, some people care, some people don't about it. It's not a huge thing, right? It sometimes carries like a small financial incentive, but it's not super relevant. Yet she felt somewhat insulted, personally insulted, and decided to withdraw from the whole tour, which is kind of a drastic decision by her. What's your take on that?
This is like one of the weirdest stories. I really don't get it. I've kind of thought about it. I just don't get it. Because, okay, so the first thing is that beauty prizes, sometimes tournaments have them, sometimes they don't. And it's usually not really a priority for players, to my knowledge. It's like something you just hope that you get.
It's not.
But you can't really control if your games will be really beautiful, and you can't control if people will like them. And it's very subjective. There's a no-brainer, right? Sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rarely.
Like, we had one during the Champions Showdown, and I think Wesley was awarded his win.
Yeah, Wesley against Levant. It wasn't even a very spectacular game. It's just that you had so few nice options to choose from. Like, I actually predicted you guys would pick that one because I was like, which other one can you possibly pick?
Right.
Maybe Levant versus Lanier, but I don't know. They were both kind of normal-ish games. I think there's sometimes it's just like a game just happens. Rarely, where you're like, okay, this has to win. Like Jin Shi Bai against Ding Liren, for example.
That was a game of the year. Yeah.
It's like, okay, you know, some spectacular sacrifices happen, Rook D4, and it's just very unusual and very beautiful. And it kind of ticks our boxes. And we're like, okay, it's still subjective, but it's as close to, like, you'll find some consensus. It's as close to objective as you'll get when it comes to beauty in chess. Or Kasparov against Topalov from Vikings A, I think it was 99. Maybe it was already after 2000. Maybe it was 2001, 2000, but I think it was 99 actually. You know, with the King Hunt and the King goes, gets mated by bishop and three pawns on a4. And then there's a few more. Like, okay, these ones, they happen once in a blue moon. Most tournaments, they have like some games that are boring, some games that are very, very accurate, but not very spectacular. And some games that are like kind of spectacular, maybe not perfect, but they're pretty cute and have some nice tactics. And it's not Kasparov Topalov, but it's still pretty nice. And maybe that one wins. But it's all subjective, right? Some people will like the perfect game, which is not very exciting. Some people will like the imperfect game, which is super exciting, right? This is maybe an accurate representation.
And most people don't care about it.
Yeah, especially and most players. People don't think too much about it, unless it's one of those once in a lifetime ones. Or like I can, you know, to give an example of a beautiful combination that I had against, I give this example often, like against Ponomaryov in Dortmund in 2014. It's just, you know, very rarely you have a really beautiful combination. So maybe there was no game prize for that tournament, but maybe if there was, I would have won it, most likely. It happens rarely that you get a beautiful combination. Sometimes your opponent just avoids it and loses it in a unspectacular way. What can you do? You know, it's not really in your control if your opponent goes for the boring loss rather than the exciting loss. But in this case, I looked at both games and I didn't feel like either one really deserved it. I mean, I looked at Lochner versus Elizabeth Petz. This is the game in question.
Well, again, it's all about the comparison, right? Like comparison between these two games. I would assume you did not watch all the games from that tournament.
No, okay, between two games. So, I mean, I did like follow the games, but of course, there's a million games they slip out of my memory.
Right.
But I reviewed these two games. And I think it's like, if you have something which cannot be questioned, like Kasparov Topalov, then you have a legitimate reason to be upset if it gets awarded to someone else. But when it's like just some game, like a fun game, don't get me wrong, very exciting to watch, you know, sacrifices, king hunt, and so on and so forth, but not particularly accurate. There was no like really beautiful sacrifice to my mind. I mean, it wasn't like you sacked a queen. It's like at some point white was down an exchange, you know, it was like an exchange sacrifice game. White was always the one attacking. I mean, basically, like, what's the spectacular move? Okay, e6 on move 12. It's actually
e6, e4, and g4, maybe.
First of all, e6 is a mistake, like a serious mistake.
Right.
So, I don't know, a move which is kind of fun. Again,
accuracy probably is not. If you want to do it by accuracy, you would probably give it.
But it's not even an exciting mistake. If black plays bishop takes e6, sacks the b7, like queen b7, knight c5, queen c6. Okay, it's tough for black to settle this. Black sacks a pawn and gets some initiative. Instead that black basically forced white's next moves, queen gets attacked, et cetera, et cetera. E4, only move not to lose a queen. I mean, you can't, do you get points for E4? You know, D takes E4. Okay. G4, not to lose your queen again, because if the knight moves, there's D3. Or at knight E5, I guess there's some other move. So G4, yeah. Again, it's bishop G4, knight E5 is a mistake. It's like maybe the biggest sacrifice of the game. It's a mistake. I mean, knight takes e4. It's like, I just can't give much credit to moves, which I'm not criticizing. It's normal to make mistakes in a very complex position, but like, am I going to give you points for making a move which objectively turns a winning position into a not winning position? And then, okay, everything else was like just standard captures, knight g6, queen d1, fe3, rook g1, check, h4, take the bishop, check. Queen f5. Then again, on move 27, white is winning, makes a very natural move, which turns out to somewhat endanger the win. And then black did not show huge resistance and played knight cd7, bishop g5, and then just lost. Although probably white is very close to winning, but still, like you can play rook f8 and then still fight on another day, maybe. It's probably hard to survive this position, but still, I don't see anything tremendous in this game. I'm not trying to be overly critical, but if it's a beauty prize, I'm not blown away by it.
What about Kostyniuk versus Stan?
Yeah, I'm also like not blown. I actually don't understand. I mean, okay, on some level, at least the other one was fun. This one wasn't even fun. I mean, maybe that's the, like, it's a fun prize, but that.
I think that's partially what it is as well.
I think it was kind of fun how, like, Black tried to come up with resources, which didn't work for, like, a billion reasons. Like, okay, knight to e3 doesn't work because of rook c1, doesn't work because of f takes e3, doesn't work because of b4 as she played. Sack to queen out of pure necessity, which doesn't work because of the king moves out of checks. Not, I mean, there was like this fun sacrifice on f3, and it obviously doesn't work because Black sacked every single piece. I would probably give it to the other game, like personally, but not because, just because they're both not very good games. And I don't know.
That's a hot take.
I would actually like just not give a beauty prize to this tournament. I would just do better next time. That's kind of mean, but like
that's rough. I mean, that is rough.
No, but this game really. If this is, let me check this tournament.
No, come on, we're not going to go through
all the games now.
Through every single game. We don't have time for that. We don't have time for that.
Like maybe another player could have complained. At least like there was. I mean, maybe there was at least some accurate game.
So, and by the way, the price for it was fairly decent. I think it was a Cartier luxury watch, which supposedly the cheapest model is $3,700. So that's a pretty significant one. But I think her overall sentiment was that she was wrong because of her affiliation, because of her being Russian, which is interesting because Kostyniuk is also Russian, but obviously she renounced that allegiance.
I'm just trying to find a game.
You're not actually watching the games, are you?
I'm only looking through the decisive games.
Okay, we don't have time for that. So your take, and I'm not going to give mine because, I like the game. I actually like the game. You know what? Let's be 1-1. I like the game. I think it should have been the deserving winner of the beauty prize. But sure, the accuracy, if you want to look into that, probably makes both of those games more or less not deserving. But
yeah, I mean, okay, the thing is, I don't know the politics behind it. I don't know who has this preference or that preference.
But we draw from a tournament for that reason, from a whole tour, from a Grand Prix tour qualifying event to the candidates. It's a little bit crazy.
No, like just to prove it's subjective, I'm going to pick another game of Lucknow. Okay. She actually played a really nice game she beat Goryachkina. I mean, it was a purely technical game. But it was a nice game.
But it's not
like purely technical. There was nothing spectacular about it.
That's what I'm saying. It's not a beauty prize.
Yeah, that's why it's really subjective. But this game that I was just like going through the games, and she won a nice game. She won a nice technical game against the highest rated player in the tournament. I believe. I think Goryachkina.
You could call that the most precise game of the event, but not necessarily the most beautiful prize of the event. The most beautiful.
Okay, game of the event. I understand. Beauty is subjective, but some people will maybe think that a very clean technical rook endgame victory is beautiful. And some people will think, I don't understand what exactly was going on with Kostyniuk's, like why that game was picked. That was just not a very interesting game. I mean, she won. That's good, but yeah, I didn't see. From that point of view, like I don't understand why that one was picked.
There you have it. But
I also don't like I don't like that game that Lucknow won against Elizabeth Petz so much. I don't think that that's like such a incredible game.
It doesn't show, in your opinion, it doesn't show a clear bias, because I think this was more or less her official statement. She withdraws from the tour because there is clear bias against Russian players.
No, but this part I cannot comment on. I have absolutely no idea what bias. I don't even know who the judges are of this. And also,
not that it matters. I think one of them was Resnička from FIDE, somebody else from FIDE. I'm trying to remember what the committee, who the committee was, but two of the players were fairly decent players, and one of them,
like,
not so much.
I once had this game against Sam Shanklin from Singfield Cup 2021, and I really thought that this was, you know, maybe one of the games that would deserve to win the beauty prize. There was a beauty prize in that tournament. I won it in the first round. And the judges didn't pick it. And I think that that game was far ahead of, like, it was accurate. It contained a queen sacrifice, not a complicated one, but still it contained a queen sacrifice. It was maybe not the most beautiful ever, but it was a queen sacrifice leading to checkmate, and good, accurate game against a strong player who made like one mistake in the game. I thought, okay, this is, maybe it's a candidate. I didn't win. I think Lanier won. I forget against who. Maybe against Maxime. And yeah, it's like, okay, this is a subjective thing. I mean, you're not always going to win the subjective battle that, I think we just chalk this up to purely subjectivity. Now, everyone maybe has some bias. We can't prove it. So probably better not to speculate on whatever bias someone might have or might not have. And just say, if you don't like the fact that it's a subjective prize, then just tell the organizer before the tournament, or just forget about it and say, okay, maybe I'll get lucky and win. Maybe I'll not get lucky. That's just how it goes with these prizes.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. It's a weird situation. We might not be even scratching the surface as to what the reasons for this withdrawal are, but that's something that obviously we don't really know or could know, because we don't have any contact with these players. Now,
also, alternative theory.
What is your...
The judges just don't really care much, and they just like are like, okay, whatever, I'll give it to this. In that case, they probably just shouldn't have a beauty prize at all, right? If they're not, but it's very likely. Just, I mean, they don't care too much. They just pick one, some game, look nice, whatever, and forget about it. And they don't expect it to be some kind of big deal, you know?
Okay, don't go for the judges now. Yeah.
No, I'm not saying like it's not, they the just judges. Don't consider it a very consequential thing. And objectively speaking, it probably isn't. Like, this Grand Prix is to decide the candidates, to decide the World Championship. World Championship has a prize fund of like 500 grand. They're probably not thinking too much about the random or kind of randomish beauty prize for a $3,000 watch. Maybe they should just get rid of it. I don't know.
There you have it.
Just put it towards a prize fund. Like, why do we have this subjective prize anyway? It's an objective sport, right?
I agree. Put it towards the prize fund. Cool. All right, Fabi. That's that. That's that for us. It's a good comeback episode. It's a long comeback episode. We'll be in Paris. Both of us will be in Paris. Maybe we'll do another one. I'm sure we'll do some more before Paris starts. But both of us will be in Paris. I'll be there for the first week. Very excited about that one. Obviously, a lot of players, a lot of stories, and I'm sure a lot of great chess will be played there. So I cannot wait for it. I will chat with you in the next one. We will have a show for the first time. We will be having a show on our channel, on our YouTube channel. We will be covering live the games from Paris, with an emphasis obviously on your game, but we will be having a full-on broadcast, so I'm excited about that as well. I don't know exactly yet who the commentators will be. I'm still working on that. I might do some of the commentary, and we might get some other commentators as well, but no matter what we do, it's going to be exciting. So keep an eye out for that, and I'll talk to you soon. Cheers, Fabi.